2020 has just been one of the worst years of American history. It's tragic. It's absolutely tragic what has happened to this country.
Americans have never felt so afraid and vulnerable.
We have kind of lost the ability to track how bad things are because every week there's something new.
But what if the worst is yet to come, with no one in charge planning to help us? For over 70 years, our leaders have told us one thing under the bright lights.
The protection of the lives and property of Americans is the responsibility of all public officials.
I care. We're trying.
And it is my first duty as president to protect the American people.
We have it so well under control.
But America's shadow government has spent trillions of dollars on secret plans that serve one premise. When the shit really hits the fan, we're on our own.
I have nothing, nothing.
For decades, the government has invested trillions of dollars in a secret plan to save itself while the rest of us die.
The most important decisions being made about the future of the United States and the fate of the Earth are being made in secret by a small elite.
Engineers too sick to maintain the power grid? The government's elite have massive generators. Cell phone system craps out? They've got their own secure network. Supermarket shelves empty? They've stockpiled enough food for years. And don't get us started on toilet paper. They've got a forest's worth stashed away.
It's this massive secret project that funneled unbelievable amounts of money towards the survival of the president and officials of government and away from the betterment of American citizens' lives.
I would like to begin by announcing some important developments in our war against the Chinese virus.
March 24th, 2020.
And making decisions.
President Trump holds a press conference to propose an end date for the growing global crisis.
Easter is our timeline. What a great timeline that would be.
My question is, you have two doctors on stage with you. Have either of them told you that's a realistic timeline?
I'd love to see it come even sooner, but I just think it would be a beautiful timeline. John?
But even as the president downplays the pandemic publicly,
it's going to disappear. One day it's like a miracle. It will disappear.
Trump knows something that most Americans don't. If the pandemic spirals out of control, there are secret plans underway for him and his top officials, even his immediate family, to be evacuated to secure facilities designed to withstand Armageddon.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
On the very same day that Trump was telling the American people the pandemic would magically disappear by Easter, 1,600 miles away, a military team is settling into life underground.
Cheyenne Mountain is one of the U.S. government's three main doomsday bunkers.
Garrett Graff is an historian and journalist. His book, Raven Rock, was the first in-depth look at the government's secret bunkers.
Inside the Cheyenne Mountain bunker, the U.S. government hid a team of military commanders.
Their mission? Command the nation's defense if it goes full zombie apocalypse above ground. It's all part of a plan that was hatched 70 years ago.
In the 1950s, the government came up with plans for a deep underground command center where the president and, you know, a few hundred staff members not only could take shelter, but also could direct a nuclear war.
The plan is called Continuity of Government, or COG.
At any moment, we could see thousands of members of the government completely wiped out, but there's a secondary government, a shadow government that is ready to take over at a moment's notice.
V
these weren't just run-of-the-mill bunkers. Some of them were entire hollowed-out mountains with small freestanding cities that could support a population of even 1,000 people for a month or longer.
The bunker system remained a secret until 1974 when a commercial airliner crashed into the side of a mountain in Virginia. The crash revealed a massive secret installation deep inside the mountain, known as Mount Weather.
Mount Weather is now an unclassified facility. Everybody knows about it. But back then, it was highly secret. It was heavily guarded, and it's where a continuity team would go in the event of a nuclear war.
The idea was that government officials could go there and they would be able to operate the government even when almost everything else had been wiped off the planet.
There would be interagency teams, people from the State Department, the Justice Department, the Pentagon, CIA, and domestic agencies.
Top civilian officials would hide away in Mount Weather, but few knew there was another secret bunker.
Every so often, you bump up against continuity of government plans. Sometimes you would spot helicopters practicing for evacuations in the skies over the city. And every so often, in a bar, an official would talk about the secret facilities that they were whisked off to.
Graf's discovery of this world and the most secret of these facilities happened by accident.
A colleague of mine found a government intelligence ID badge on the floor of a parking garage. On the back were directions, and it just made me wonder, what else is out there? So that launched me on this journey to try to map this secret world out there that I didn't realize ever existed. And the biggest thing I found was the doomsday facility known as Raven Rock.
Raven Rock, like Area 51, remains one of the U.S. government's most classified installations.
Could you describe a Raven Rock to me, like what it is, what it's for?
No.
Raven Rock is an underground backup Pentagon.
It's the most unbelievable place you can imagine. You're 768 feet below the surface.
Don Camel spent 3.5 years at Raven Rock as part of the president's communication team. He's never spoken on camera before about his time working in the secret bunker.
Basically, they carved out a city underground that could survive a direct hit from a nuclear blast. After you go through the security, you walk in and it's basically an underground tunnel. There's a glass door that was 3.5 foot thick that weighed 30 tons. You go through like an airlock, and they had two of those doors, and then you walk another half a mile.
A half mile deeper into the mountain is the bunker itself.
And you're going past five buildings. Those represent the five rings of the Pentagon. And each of those buildings are three stories tall, and they probably have 50 to 80 offices per floor.
The buildings are mounted on springs to survive the shock waves from a nuclear blast.
There's a common cafeteria capable of serving 3,000 people, three meals a day for 30 days on lockdown. They had a barbershop in there with one chair.
It's got massive reservoirs, generators, even a crematorium if needed, post office, medical facilities, and emergency command and communication links to the U.S. military all around the world.
As part of the White House team, Camel had access to the most restricted part of the bunker. The presidential suite.
The presidential suite is a very secure area. The other people in the site, they had no access, and they were very, very curious as far as what was behind the door. The presidential bedroom was, of course, a king-size bed. Then there was a separate kitchen set up in our suite to feed 30 or 40 people. The presidential office overlooked the war room, which had the same display that was a duplicate of what they had in the Pentagon. We would look down, and of course they'd look up, and they couldn't see through the glass because it was a one-way glass.
To understand why these bunkers were created, you have to rewind to the 1950s. For some, it was America's golden age. but it was also the dawn of a ruthless fight for global supremacy.
The United States and the Soviet Union stand on the verge of direct military confrontation,
in which both sides built up an arsenal of spectacularly powerful weapons. That meant the next World War would not last years, but minutes.
There might be as little as 15 minutes notice of an attack that could wipe out much of civilization as we know it. And so the Eisenhower administration began an elaborate process of contingency planning. And if we only had a few minutes, then they didn't want to have any sort of layers of review or approval that would slow down the process of responding to a major emergency.
To avoid mass panic, the U.S. government had created a nationwide civil defense program.
We all know the atomic bomb is very dangerous. Since it may be used against us, we must get ready for it.
Growing up in the 1950s, there were fallout shelters, places where you would go if the nuclear war occurred. And in those fallout shelters, there was water, there were prescription drugs. And the notion really was that you could go there and survive.
The government starts telling Americans that not only can they survive a nuclear war, but they could go on living their lives as long as they come together in an unquestioning mass.
Duck and cover. This family knows that even a thin cloth helps protect them. Even a newspaper can save you from a bad burn.
But while the public was being told to build shelters and duck under their desks, the government elite were going to hide under tons of rock and reinforced concrete.
There was an awareness at the highest level of the American government that these civil defense drills were really window dressing. This was a massive, massive propaganda effort that bore almost no relationship to reality whatsoever. President Eisenhower knew that this was all bullshit. He said things like, if nuclear war comes, there aren't going to be enough bulldozers to scrape the bodies off the streets.
If the Soviet bombs started dropping, everyone was going to die. Everyone, that is, but the chosen few. The president and the government elite would ride out Armageddon in massive nuclear-proof bunkers, while American citizens died in the millions. And while the average American was oblivious to this elitist double standard, in other circles it was famously mocked.
Dr. Strangelove, the Kubrick film, does an amazing job of parodying the whole notion of the nuclear bunker and decisions being made by a small elite.
Because it would be absolutely vital that our top government and military men be included to foster and impart the required principles of leadership and tradition.
But the truth is even stranger than fiction. The bunkers are just the beginning. These secret government plans include a secret air force, secret communication networks, a secret monetary system, and a classified plan to suspend democracy itself. And it all still exists and could be put into action right now. The U.S. government spent billions of dollars to build a secret bunker system to save themselves in the case of nuclear war. But one thing the system lacks is how to restrain an out-of-control president with his finger on the button from starting that war in the first place. July 2017. Kim Jong-un's regime test fires an intercontinental ballistic missile capable of hitting the United States. President Trump counters with a barrage of his own.
North Korea best not make any more threats to the United States. They will be met with fire and fury like the world has never seen.
And a war of words quickly escalates into a full-blown crisis.
The United States has great strength and patience, but if it is forced to defend itself, we will have no choice but to totally destroy North Korea.
Meanwhile, as the crisis mounts, North Korea's propaganda machine goes into overdrive. While Trump's late-night tweets cause many to fear the United States is 140 characters away from war.
The President of the United States, in a split second, without questioning, can end the world itself, which is a completely unprecedented and disturbing development for an executive branch which has grown in power and scope.
Defense Secretary Jim Mattis and Homeland Security Secretary John Kelly made a pact at the beginning of the Trump administration to ensure that one of them was always available to clarify any orders coming out of the White House.
During the North Korean missile crisis, James Mattis even sleeps in his clothes, ready for action at a moment's notice. But there's little they or any other top officials can do to stop the president if he wants to launch a nuclear strike.
The United States is ready, willing, and able. Rocket Man is on a suicide mission for himself and for his regime.
We have a president who is so dangerous because this is a person who not only has unilateral authority to use nuclear weapons, but has multiple times now and repeatedly shown a desire to do so. At one point, he actually considered the idea that a nuclear weapon could destroy a hurricane.
If North Korea's Rocket Man actually launched one of his nuclear missiles at the United States, a secret evacuation plan would have kicked into gear. To get the president and his shadow government to the Raven Rock or Mount Weather bunkers, a vast transportation network was created. You may know it as Marine One, the helicopter that takes Trump golfing.
Everyone sees us land on the White House lawn, shiny green and white helicopter takes the president back and forth to help him fulfill his executive agenda for that day.
But Marine One is part of a fleet of highly specialized aircraft that have a much more serious function.
We've taken those airframes and we've modernized it and we've hardened it against all kinds of threats. The real bread and butter comes from the communication equipment. Our president can pick up that phone inside Marine One and talk to any world leader, any combatant commander. He can go through the Pentagon and talk to the Joint Chiefs of Staff.
And if the president can't get to one of the secret bunkers, an entire Air Force exists to provide sanctuary in the skies.
Right now, at this exact moment, there's a plane sitting on a runway, its engines are running, it's fully staffed. It could be airborne in less than 15 minutes.
Officially called night watch aircraft, they're known as the president's doomsday planes.
They've been modified so much that the price tag on them is about 10 times the normal cost of a regular commercial 747.
Manned by a crew of up to 114, planes have 5,000 square feet of conference rooms, communication centers, and private quarters. To ensure electronics aren't fried by an electromagnetic pulse from an atomic blast, the planes are covered in wire mesh.
Basically, it's a flying battle station. The president can use it in times of war to fight back against any adversary.
And to order a retaliatory strike, the president would turn to the world's most powerful briefcase.
In a country that doesn't have crown jewels or royal throne, the physical manifestation of all of the president's vast powers is embodied in the black briefcase that is never more than a few steps away from the president.
The so-called nuclear football briefcase is the closest thing to the mythical and often misunderstood button the president can push to unleash Armageddon.
If the United States were under attack, the president probably has 10 minutes, 8 minutes to make a decision about whether to retaliate and about what form of retaliation to order. Inside, there'd be the black book, and the black book has visual representations of what the different attack options would be. Maybe like the menu at restaurants that show you the pictures of what you're gonna order.
he would communicate to the Pentagon, first of all, who he was, authenticating himself with an elaborate code, and then he would communicate the option he had chosen.
5, 8, 7, 6,
from the time that the president gives an order, the first missiles will leave their silos 4 minutes later.
And that decision would kill hundreds of millions of people. And perhaps put the Earth into a nuclear winter for a decade or longer, destroying civilization. He has to make that decision in a matter of minutes. That's almost an impossible decision for any human being to make.
The nuclear football is based in trust. It's the idea that the president has the nation's best interests at heart, that the president is the most logical and calculating thinker that you can imagine. All of that begins to fall apart if the president himself is the threat to the nation.
This wasn't the first time a seemingly unstable president pushed the limits of America's doomsday machine.
Nixon took the country and the world to the brink of nuclear war for no reason other than politics.
October 27, 1969. Hippies dancing in the street are oblivious to the fact that their arch enemy, President Richard Nixon, has just ordered 18 nuclear-armed B-52 bombers to take off and head towards the Soviet Union. Like Trump, Nixon had run as the law and order candidate. He also claimed to have a secret plan to end the Vietnam War.
For 4 years, we haven't had a moment of peace abroad. For 4 years, we haven't had a moment of peace at home. My friends, when it goes that far, it's time to make a change.
But now the country and the war are spiraling out of control. And the newly elected president is desperate.
Nixon decides to start acting in a completely unpredictable manner. He wants not just the Soviet Union, but the people of Vietnam to believe that he could unleash the power of the nuclear bomb at any moment.
He began loading up nuclear weapons on B-52s and flying them in a way that suggested that he was crazy enough to use them. President Nixon believed that if he could persuade the Soviets that he was willing to use nuclear weapons, that it might lead to a peaceful conclusion of the war.
The challenge with that was that the other side might believe that you would actually start a war.
Any miscalculation by the Soviets might have easily tipped the world into a nuclear exchange. And if the Soviets had believed Nixon was crazy enough to start World War III, they would have begun to unleash their vast nuclear arsenal.
Nuclear war is basically like a shootout in the Old West. Whoever shoots first has a better chance of survival.
Soviet missiles raining down across the United States, the American people would pay a heavy price for Nixon poking the Soviet bear.
They had the capability to wipe out New York, Chicago, Los Angeles. It would have been a cataclysmic war for the United States, and there was no way that we could prevent that.
scientists led by Carl Sagan determined that a full-scale nuclear war using hundreds or thousands of nuclear weapons couldn't be fought without effectively destroying civilization and perhaps destroying humanity as a species. The survivors would envy the dead.
The American people didn't know just how close they came to Armageddon in October 1969. The Soviets called Nixon's bluff and didn't cave into his provocation.
It was a tactic that didn't work, but the fact that he could do it at all is unbelievable.
If the bombs had started dropping, Nixon would have turned to the secret instruction manual for handling such a massive national emergency. That would give him the right to rip up the Constitution and throw away your rights. And a version is still on the books and available for our current president to use.
When somebody's the president of the United States, the authority is total.
But I have the right to do a lot of things that people don't even know about.
The president of the United States calls the shots.
Most Americans don't realize the secret laws and secret authorities that have built up around the presidency.
As a result of the Cold War, the American presidency has grown in power exponentially in ways that the founders never could have possibly imagined.
Then I have an Article 2 where I have the right to do whatever I want as president, but I don't even talk about that.
I can't think of any president who has ever claimed that Article 2 of the Constitution gives him the power to do whatever he wants. But even then, he has the ability to use secret legal memos and presidential orders known as presidential emergency action documents.
The little-known presidential emergency action documents are top-secret orders that grant the president vast, sweeping powers in the case of a national emergency.
These presidential emergency action documents are sort of like a loaded weapon that has never actually been deployed. They are executive orders, proclamations, and directives that are drafted in anticipation of a range of worst-case scenarios, ready for the president's signature in the event that one of those scenarios were to come to pass. What's extraordinary about these presidential emergency action documents is that none of them has ever been released or even leaked. These documents are not shared with Congress, even though they go to the heart of the government's plans for responding to a major emergency.
We don't know what the secret powers are. We don't know when they could be invoked. And we don't know what American democracy would look like afterward.
We have much less information about the contents of current presidential emergency action documents, but we do know what was in some of these up through the early 1970s. These purported to authorize martial law, the roundup and detention of people listed on an index of so-called subversives that was maintained by the FBI, censorship of the press, warrantless seizures of property, and the suspension of habeas corpus by the president, not by the Congress, as provided in the Constitution, which basically means that people could be imprisoned without judicial review. These documents still exist, and we know that there were 56 of them in 2018. They are periodically revised and updated to address current threats. For example, a cyber attack, pandemics. And it's not as if nuclear warheads have gone away. We also know that the purpose of them is to imagine the outer limits of how far the president might possibly need to go and to prepare for that scenario.
With the power of life and death over the entire planet and the ability to kick in secret laws that could override the Constitution, the office of the President of the United States has been imbued with almost godlike powers. To ensure there's always someone to wield these incredible powers, a vast system of presidential succession has been created.
The goal was someone somewhere was always ready to step into the presidency. The president may die, the presidency
always lives.
And having someone ready is never more important than on the day all of the nation's elected officials gather for the peaceful transfer of presidential power.
I, Donald John Trump, do solemnly swear
that I will.
In that void of 7 hours and 32 minutes, had catastrophe struck, I would have become the president.
I, Donald John Trump, do solemnly swear.
I, Donald John Trump, do solemnly swear
that I will faithfully execute.
That I will faithfully execute
the office of President of the United States.
The office of President of the United States.
January 20th, 2017. Donald J. Trump is sworn in as the 45th president after a campaign that divided the nation.
So help me God.
Congratulations.
If anything happened to the man elected president, another man is waiting under guard far from the Capitol.
While the world is watching in Washington, Homeland Security Secretary Jay Johnson has been hidden away at a secure location, ready to take over if something terrible happens in Washington. He's the latest in a long line of designated survivors, officials picked in advance in the presidential line of succession to ensure that at high-profile events, there's always one person ready to step in if the unthinkable happens.
Obama's Secretary of Homeland Security, Jay Johnson, was once one of the federal lawyers who signed off on the assassination of Osama bin Laden.
On January 20, 2017, I actually had a fantasy about how that day was going to go for me. I was very much looking forward to leaving office with the rest of the Obama administration. And I actually had an app on my phone that counted down the days, hours, minutes until January 20, 2017 at noon, but it didn't happen that way. At the very last minute, I was asked to be the designated survivor.
The idea of the designated survivor is a relatively recent invention. The recognition that the speed and terror of nuclear weapons in the modern age requires the ability to hand off the presidency in a matter of minutes. The goal was someone somewhere was always ready to step into the presidency.
Thank you. There is a fair amount of thinking that goes into it, and the designated survivor would, in the event all the others in the presidential line of succession ahead of him or her, would assume the office of the presidency.
The line of succession moves down through the cabinet in the order in which the cabinet departments were created, beginning with the Secretary of State. And it goes through all the federal departments until it gets to the Secretary of Homeland Security.
In that void of 7 hours and 32 minutes, had catastrophe struck.
What a great honor to be able to introduce for the first time ever anywhere the 45th President of the United States of America, Donald J. Trump.
I would have become the president.
While the American people had voted a Republican president into the office, if the unthinkable had happened that day, the president of the United States would have been a Democrat and a man who never attempted to run for president. But while the designated survivor is a publicly known plan to ensure the survival of the presidency during major events, there's another secret plan that goes even further.
The continuity of government plans ensured the line of presidential succession in a way that would be unrecognizable to most Americans.
The idea was that the scale of damage could be so great that everybody in the constitutional line of succession would be gone, and they would have to reach way beyond the constitutional order of succession.
In the event of a surprise catastrophic attack on Washington, a host of officials far from the Capitol would suddenly raise their hands and announce themselves as the country's new leadership.
People you might have heard of, like United States Attorney for the District of Illinois in Chicago, but you would never imagine that that person would be president of the United States. But under these plans, there was an entire government that was built separate and apart from what's contemplated in the Constitution.
Whether you come to office because of the death of the president or the resignation of the president or election by the people, you have all of the trappings, the authority, and the responsibilities of the office, including being the commander-in-chief of the armed forces.
And the president retains all those trappings, responsibilities, and authority, even after losing an election.
In the early hours of November the 4th, the man once rated the most popular United States president in history conceded defeat.
The United States is unusual in having a particularly long period between the election of one president and the departure of another president. It's about 2.5 months. What that means is you have a commander-in-chief who may have been rejected by the American people, but still has the sole authority to use nuclear weapons, has tremendous power.
America might face one of the most perilous chapters of its history. As a man who has shown no respect for democracy or our democratic institutions faces a lame duck period where he has all of the authority of the office and none of the sense of responsibility.
Will you pledge tonight that you will not declare victory until the election has been independently certified?
If I see tens of thousands of ballots being manipulated, I can't go along with that.
Donald Trump may have lost the election, but during the so-called lame duck period, a president of the United States retains all the vast powers the office has accumulated over the last 70 years.
So there is this period of 3 months during which a president who has been defeated or whose second term has expired or is about to expire, nonetheless is in charge of the military. Let's imagine a scenario where a president loses his bid for re-election and then loses his mind, in part because of the defeat, in part because of some previously existing mental problem. He loses control. If a president rolled out of bed on one day and wanted to end the world and called in the code, and there was no war going on, our hope would be that the military officers receiving the go codes might ask for higher authority or simply say, "No, Mr. President, that is not a legal order." But technically, they don't have to. If the president says go, they're supposed to go.
We've seen so many of the institutions of the United States buckle under President Trump, the courts, the Senate, the Justice Department. Maybe I'm overly hopeful, but the military seems to be one of the last institutions that he hasn't managed to corrupt.
It wouldn't be the first time that a president's ability to unleash America's nukes was restrained.
For over 4 months, Watergate has dominated the news media. It is my constitutional responsibility to defend the integrity of this great office against false charges.
As Watergate began to take down the Nixon presidency, Richard Nixon began to unravel. His drinking was out of control. He was wandering the halls of the White House, talking to the portraits and talking to himself and talking to God. He would talk about picking up a phone and bombing his enemies.
So Secretary of Defense James Schlesinger let it be known to the Joint Chiefs of Staff that any order to use nuclear weapons by Nixon had to go through him. Now, technically, if Schlesinger had overruled Nixon on the use of nuclear weapons, it would have been an act of mutiny. But he was sufficiently concerned about Nixon's mental health that he wanted to make sure there wouldn't be a catastrophe.
But even if nuclear war can be averted by clear-headed officials, all lame-duck presidents have the ability to invoke the top-secret presidential emergency action documents.
We know that the Department of Justice was in the process of updating these documents as recently as 2018. So the question becomes, what does the Trump administration view as the outer limits of presidential power.
When somebody's the president of the United States, the authority is total. And that's the way it's got to be.
Your authority is total.
That is not true. Who told you the president has the total authority?
Enough.
Trump has repeatedly hinted about the secret powers and the unimaginable capabilities that he could have in an emergency. The challenge is we don't literally know what those are.
The worst case scenario is if this president were to exploit the actual emergency presented by COVID-19 and or to try to manufacture emergencies, maybe by provoking violence in relation to some of the protests around police brutality, and to use those situations as a pretext to deploy the military or to engage in other extreme uses of emergency powers in a way that could undermine a fair and free election and undermine our democracy.
They say that they're going to threaten riots if they lose on election night. What are you going
to
do?
We'll put them down very quickly if they do that. We have the right to do that. We have the power to do that if we want. Look, it's called insurrection. We just send in and we do it very easy.
In that extreme situation, if all of these powers were deployed, what you're looking at is a democracy turning into an autocracy.
We're entering a very perilous chapter of American history. When you can't trust that the president is acting in the nation's best interests.
Any attempt to really impose martial law, I think, would ultimately fail. But I could imagine the arrest of key members of Congress or leading figures in the United States that would profoundly harm our democratic systems even more severely than they are right now. By the way, I can't even fucking believe that we're talking about these scenarios. We're talking about a scenario of a president imposing martial law. The fact that this conversation is even happening is a sign of how bad things are in the United States right now.
We need to look at how presidents can be restrained and how bad faith actors can be restrained. Because here we have a president, God knows what he could possibly get into in 2 months, particularly being a scorned, unstable, unhealthy individual.
These plans and powers enable the president to cause as much chaos and damage as he wants, knowing he'll be safe down in his bunker, while above him, the rest of us are left to die.
Since the beginning of the nuclear age in 1945, decisions of incredibly profound importance have been made by a small number of policymakers in Washington, D.C., mainly in secret. And it's really important that the American people understand these issues, educate themselves about these issues, and be part of the process of debating them and making the decisions, because the consequences of these decisions are almost unimaginable.
. 2020 is the beginning of the age of catastrophe. It's kind of the future warning us.
How do we want justice? We can't get justice!
There's so much uncertainty, discontent, fear.
The apocalypse is sort of closing in on us from all sides.
It turns out none of the plans that we had developed during the Cold War would work.
Everybody out!
He goes, you can lock on to him, shoot him. Shoot him.
We've seen it with earthquakes, hurricanes, and now a pandemic. Just how wide the chasm is between the powerful and the rest of us.
It is fascinating how this disaster seemed to disproportionately affect poor black people.
I think we had a major catastrophic event. You could see America would do well in the first 7 to 10 days.
And the shutdown now!
Then you're going to immediately fall into chaos.
Back up! Back up!
the world is kind of on fire. And the elites are retreating into bunkers.